Depression, the Way Out by Dr. Neil Nedley. Lifestyle Treatments for Depression. Chapter 5. Amanda had experienced rectal bleeding and severe abdominal cramps for 4 weeks. She had waited for her symptoms to go away with medication, but instead she was feeling worse and the bleeding was becoming more severe. She had been diagnosed a few years earlier with ulcerative colitis, had undergone treatment with medication, and her symptoms had gradually abated. She had encountered several minor episodes of pain and bleeding since, and each time returned to her medication with resulting improvement. When it became clear that the medication was not working, she was referred to me for further evaluation. During the interview, Amanda stated that she'd been suffering from depression for more than 10 years, and if it weren't for Prozac and now Zoloft, she didn't know how she could have made it. She was taking Advil almost continuously for various muscle aches and severe headaches, which she did not recognize were complications of depression. There were times when she had felt reasonably happy and had attempted to wean herself from the antidepressants, but within days she would have uncontrolled crying spells that her husband could not tolerate, and she would have to resume the drugs. She was overweight, but said that she had never been overweight until she became depressed and was placed on Prozac. She put on 20 pounds within a few months and continued to put on a few more over the years. Going through several medication changes did not improve her weight. Now her abdominal pain had worsened significantly over the last month to the point that even narcotic pain medication was not controlling it. As I examined her, I found that the left and lower portions of her abdomen were exquisitely tender to the point that tears quickly came to her eyes. She almost jumped off the exam table during slight hand pressure on the abdomen. I chose to deal first with her most severe and acute symptoms, the bleeding and abdominal pain. Amanda's blood work revealed she was quite anemic, although not yet in need of a blood transfusion. She underwent a bowel cleanse that day, and I performed a colonoscopy the following day. It revealed severe, large ulcers with redness and swelling of the non-ulcerated colon tissue. Her colon biopsies revealed severe, active, ulcerative colitis. I placed her on an appropriate medical therapy and on a diet higher in omega-3 fats, which can help ulcerative colitis, and had her stop the Advil and similar pain and anti-inflammatory medications. 2 weeks later, her ulcerative colitis symptoms had improved significantly, but Amanda was having a very hard time dealing with headaches, especially without Advil. It became clear that we needed additional ways to treat Amanda's depression beyond her antidepressant medications. I put her on a lifestyle approach outlined in this chapter as well as in chapter 4 of this book. Within 1 month, Amanda was feeling so much better that she stopped her antidepressant medications. Usually, I wait for 4 to 6 months after instituting lifestyle treatments before attempting to withdraw most mental medications that have been used for years. Amanda was aware of this, but on her own, she decided to experiment and stop taking the drugs. 1 year later, Amanda is still free from antidepressants and is feeling better than she has her entire adult life. She's almost down to her ideal weight and no longer feels the need for Advil or other over-the-counter head and muscle ache remedies. She still requires mild medications to keep her ulcerative colitis from flaring up, but her doctor bills are much less, and she is elated over being mentally healthy without the drugs she had previously thought she had to take for the rest of her life. Her only regret is that she did not understand earlier that depression could actually be treated by nutrition and lifestyle measures. Treating depression via lifestyle. As important as nutrition is in treating depression, my experience has demonstrated that in most people, other lifestyle treatments for depression are even more important. There are many safe lifestyle treatments that will benefit anyone who practices such an approach, whether or not they are depressed. These lifestyle changes I advocate for almost anyone, but I insist upon them for my depressed patients. They are bright light therapy, avoiding negative thinking, regular restful sleep, daily spiritual exercises, regular physical exercises, deep breathing exercises, and classical music therapy. I will explore each of these 7 general lifestyle treatments, followed by 6 other lifestyle treatments for depression that I prescribe for specific cases. Regular physical exercise. It should not be surprising that exercise can manage depression. Since it helps improve so many body functions, why shouldn't we expect it to improve the function of the mind as well? Even if you're not depressed, physical exercise is good for the mind. A very large study from the National Institute of Health looked at 1,900 healthy subjects It showed that women who exercised only occasionally or not at all have twice the risk of developing major depression within 8 years compared with those that exercise moderately at least several times a week. Physical activity not only prevents depression, but it is also good treatment for those who are depressed. Further, it is useful for treating other mental illnesses, including episodes of anxiety, ongoing anxiety, and panic disorder. New evidence indicates that regular workouts may help soothe deep sadness as effectively as antidepressant medications. What kind of exercises and how much is needed? Exercise that requires rhythmic motion of the large muscle groups, such as walking, jogging, swimming, and cycling, at least 30 minutes 3 times per week, but 30 minutes 6 times per week is better. Researchers at Duke University tested people with major depression and found that a moderate exercise program, 30 minutes 3 times per week, reduced depression as well as antidepressant medication. The medications produced results more quickly, but after 16 weeks, the exercise effect caught up, according to the study. At least a partial explanation of the mental benefits is that exercise causes the brain to produce more serotonin and norepinephrine, which are neurotransmitters in the brain that can reduce depression. After reviewing all the studies published since 1981 on exercise and mental health, Canadian researchers found that exercise, whether it is strength training, running, walking, or other forms of aerobic exercise, help to alleviate mild to moderate depression. It also helps in treatment of other mental disorders, including anxiety, substance abuse disorders, body image disorders, and even attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The amount of exercise varied in the studies from 20-minute sessions to up to 60-minute sessions at least 3 times per week. Physical exercise brings about better results than most counseling approaches and is certainly much more cost-effective. Another study showed that as little as 8 minutes of daily vigorous exercise on an inclined treadmill to the point of exhaustion reduced symptoms of depression as well as tension, anger, and fatigue. It is important for the depressed patient to realize that they likely will not feel any better after their first few exercise sessions. This is in contrast to those who are suffering from tension, anxiety, anger, or fatigue. Exercise will tend to improve their symptoms even after the first session. Not so with people suffering from major depression. Thus, a depressed person will often stop their recently started exercise routine thinking that it's not doing them any good. In my experience, it takes at least a week of daily exercise before depressive symptoms begin to improve in most individuals. And there's more good news. Once the symptoms begin to improve, they usually continue to gradually improve over the course of 4 to 6 months, during which the maximum effect is finally achieved. There are additional mental benefits associated with exercise. Researchers who discovered that exercise counteracted depression also found that after 4 months of regular aerobic exercise, memory and other mental abilities were improved. All these benefits are not limited to the young. A study followed more than 900 older adults, average age of 70, for 1 year and found that those who exercised regularly at the start of the study but later quit were more likely to develop depression compared with those who stayed active. The quitters and those who never exercised during the study had the highest scores on a depression test at the end of the study. Specifically, mood benefits were seen in those whose regular exercise caused them to break a sweat. Even those who did any kind of exercise just 3 times a week were less likely to have depressed moods. Interestingly, the older participants who took up exercising during the study got a mood boost, similar to those who had exercised throughout the study. In other words, no matter how old you are, you will benefit by starting a good exercise program. I tell my depressed patients that they need to commit themselves to a regularly scheduled, not haphazard, exercise program for life. They can vary the type of exercise so that it does not become monotonous. For instance, one of my patients does brisk walking on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, runs on Mondays and Fridays, swims on Wednesdays, and lifts weights on Sunday. If you want to bring a friend along and socialize during exercise sessions, do so. But do not depend on a friend in order to exercise, otherwise you will eventually stop exercising. Choosing pleasant surroundings to exercise helps maintain a program. Fortunately, the benefits of physical exercise do not stop with improved mental health. Additional benefits are that it increases HDL cholesterol, the good cholesterol, decreases blood pressure, improves insulin sensitivity, strengthens bones, helps control obesity, decreases the risk of gallstones, helps control osteoarthritis, improves fibromyalgia, and decreases the risk of certain cancers. Deep breathing exercises. Exercising muscles requires an abundant supply of oxygen. For this reason, maximal physical performance necessitates deep breathing. However, most people don't think it is obvious that deep breathing has profound effects on mental performance. This section, however, deals with the benefits of deep breathing apart from physical exercise. A simple, readily available test in many doctors' offices is an oxygen saturation test. A probe is placed on the finger or earlobe, and a blood oxygen saturation is measured. A blood oxygen saturation of less than 95% is associated with decreased ability to perform complex mental tasks. When a person is sitting in a classroom, in a church, or even on the sofa socializing or watching television, the blood oxygen saturation often drops to levels less than 95%. This can happen even though they may have a completely healthy pair of lungs. Why does it occur? Because of shallow breathing, which in turn is often associated with poor posture. One study showed that lower oxygen levels adversely affect mood, impair muscle function, impair metabolic function, lead to muscle atrophy, and leads to exercise intolerance. Another study examined blood oxygen levels in cardiac patients and normal subjects during both spontaneous breathing and periods of controlled breathing to determine the effect of respiratory rate on arterial oxygen saturation. Controlled breathing at the rate of 3 to 15 breaths per minute improved blood oxygen levels, but ideal oxygen levels were reached during deep breathing at 3 to 6 breaths per minute. To prevent shortness of breath while breathing only 3 times a minute, it is imperative that the breaths be very deep. Since maintaining 3 breaths a minute throughout a normal day activity seems unrealistic, Dr. Bernardi, the study's lead author, had participants do slow, deep breathing at 6 breaths per minute for 1 hour a day. This not only improved blood oxygen levels during the exercises, but also throughout the entire day. It also had a pleasant side effect of improving exercise tolerance in patients with a heart condition. This improvement was additive to other forms of treatment. Interestingly, the value and importance of deep breathing given by modern researchers was recognized 100 years ago by Ellen White. She wrote, "The one who sits and stands erect is more likely than others to breathe properly, but the teacher should impress upon his pupils the importance of deep breathing. Show how the healthy action of the respiratory organs assisting the circulation of the blood invigorates the whole system. It excites the appetite, promotes digestion, and induces sound, sweet sleep, thus not only refreshing the body, but soothing and tranquilizing the mind. And while the importance of deep breathing is shown, the practice should be insisted upon. Let exercises be given, which will promote this, and see that the habit becomes established." It is important to maintain proper posture, especially for people who are depressed or are not handling stress well. I encourage my patients to utilize deep breathing techniques during their physical exercise sessions. Throughout the rest of the day, when conscious of their breathing, they are to attempt to breathe deeply 6 breaths per minute. At first, it will require the use of a watch and taking a breath every 10 seconds. But after some practice, they will be able to do this without looking at a watch. I also encourage deep breathing while performing the next lifestyle measure, classical music therapy. Classical music therapy. Music therapy to improve mood and mental function is not a new practice. Thousands of years ago, King Saul had a problem with depression. It even got into the way of his ability to function as king. His physician advisors recommended, "Let our Lord now command thy servants, which are before thee, to seek out a man who is a cunning player on a harp. And it shall come to pass that when the evil spirit from God is upon thee, that he shall play with his hand, and thou shalt be well." And it came to pass, when the evil spirit from God was upon Saul, that David took an harp and played with his hand. So Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him. Facts about the benefits of music in combating mental disorders are that mental health benefits of music have been well proven, but not all kinds of music are beneficial. Classical music has been found to be the most effective, even among those who do not know it or even prefer it. Not all music will improve mood. Each person tends to have musical preferences, but even listening to these musical favorites will not always improve mood after the music stops. Music psychotherapy, in which people are encouraged to associate mental images with classical music, can improve mood and reduce stress. After 6 sessions of guided imagery and music therapy, held over a 12-week period, 14 healthy adult volunteers ages 23 to 45 showed improved scores on tests of overall mood, and reported feeling less fatigue and depression. The improvement was more than just subjective. The patient's blood levels of the steroid hormone cortisol, which elevates during stress, also fell significantly. In the GIM therapy sessions, volunteers listened to specific selected sequences of classical music, including portions from the music of Ravel, Bach, and Brahms. To encourage introspection while listening, they were asked to identify 1 to 3 areas of concern in their life. They then shared and discussed with the therapist the spontaneous images that came to mind during the music selections. 13 weeks into the study, test scores on mood disturbance, fatigue, and depression were significantly decreased compared with the pre-GIM therapy session scores. The changes persisted at a follow-up 6 weeks later. However, no significant changes in test scores or cortisol levels were found among 14 volunteers, control subjects, who did not undergo classical GIM therapy. This study did not allow people to choose their own musical preference. Most people in the 23 to 45-year-old age group have never been seriously exposed to enough classical music to choose it as a preference. Yet, traditional classical music is the only style of music that has been demonstrated to improve mental health both subjectively and objectively to date. I recommend that individuals listen intently to classical music no less than 1 hour every 2 weeks. This can take place in a live concert or in a church if traditional classical hymns and other classical music numbers are performed, on your living room stereo system, or in your automobile. The only requirement is that the individuals think of areas of concern in their life and keep their imagination active during the performance. Regular restful sleep. Another general lifestyle treatment for depression is regular restful sleep. As mentioned in Chapter 4, a continual lack of adequate sleep can lead to depression. In turn, depression in and of itself can then lead to insomnia. Fortunately, many of the general lifestyle measures that I recommend are related to each other and often can be practiced together. Sleepless nights and feelings of despair are very closely linked, according to a study conducted by the National Institutes of Mental Health. The Institute compared various sleep complaints and symptoms of depression in about 8,000 subjects. Insomnia was reported by 10% of the subjects. About 40% of those with insomnia developed a mental disorder. The risk of major depression among insomniacs was 40 times higher than those who had no insomnia. Those who experienced temporary sleeplessness had a 60% greater likelihood that they would fall prey to a depressive episode. Note that mental disorders are strongly linked to insomnia. In this study, a sleep problem that continued for at least 1 year was defined as insomnia. The risk of new major depression was extremely high, a whopping 40 times more likely in those with chronic insomnia than those who typically get a good night's sleep. But notice that even among those experiencing a temporary bout with sleeplessness, there was a 60% greater likelihood that they would also fall prey to a depressive episode. An even greater percent of those with hypersomnia, excessive sleep, developed a mental disorder compared with 16% of those with normal sleep habits. It has also been discovered that women are about 30% more likely to be insomniacs than men, and the prevalence of problems with sleep increases as people age. In older adults, insomnia not only contributes to depression, but also to memory impairment. According to Dr. Peter Hari and his colleagues at the Mayo Sleep Disorder Center, being physically fit can prevent spasmodic sleep. People who exercise fall asleep more easily, awake less during the night, and sleep more efficiently than those who do not. This may be associated with what is called circadian cycling, which is explained in Chapter 3. An increased metabolism, faster heart rate, and elevated body temperature are associated with poor sleep. Initially, exercise increases the metabolism, but a few hours after completing the exercise session, the body temperature and metabolism drops to a lower level than if the person had not exercised. This is why exercise just before retiring should be avoided, especially if it is possible to exercise in the late afternoon or early evening, which helps induce sleep. The form of exercise can be as simple as a brisk walk several times around the block. Exercising outdoors in sunshine is advisable whenever possible. One factor in the ability to sleep well is that as we get older, there is a steady sharp decline in the production of melatonin, a hormone that helps induce sleep. The decline begins before age 10 and continues through age 70, at which time it is reduced to only about 2% of the amount that a youth produces. This decline is partly due to lifestyle practices that interfere with the production of this important sleep aid. Some people make the mistake of staying up late with the idea of getting tired enough to fall asleep more easily, but exposure to artificial light when burning the midnight oil actually interferes with melatonin production. Failing to get adequate sunlight during waking hours may also diminish melatonin production. For more information on this subject, see the chapter entitled Melatonin in the book Proof Positive. Nicotine withdrawal makes sleeping difficult for many individuals, but this should last only 2 to 3 weeks after quitting smoking. Sleeping and waking at irregular times may cause insomnia in some people. Others may use stimulants such as coffee or other caffeine drinks to stay awake during the day and alcohol to later fall asleep. But these artificial means of encouraging alertness or sleep have been found to compound the problem. A host of medications can also cause insomnia. Just about any medication that has an effect on the brain can cause or aggravate insomnia in some people. This list includes anti-anxiety, antidepressants, anti-seizure, stimulants, and antipsychotic medications. Many other medications that are not designed to affect the mind can cause insomnia. This list would include certain antibiotics such as Cipro and Floxacin, hormones such as prednisone, breathing medications such as theophylline, antihistamine, and many other drugs. Eating just before retiring or eating a heavy meal in the evening often contributes to heartburn or acid reflux, and insomnia can result. Simply going to bed with a full stomach will cause less than a restful night's sleep. When the evening meal is eaten 3 or 4 hours before retiring, digestion will usually be completed, and superior, more efficient rest will be experienced. Insomnia will improve when the order of meals is reversed, shifting the bulk of the day's calories to the breakfast and lunch meals and choosing light and easily digested foods for the evening meal. A simple fruit meal is an excellent choice for the third meal. For some individuals, cutting out the evening meal altogether may prove to be a very helpful sleep aid. If there is a feeling of hunger, try drinking 8 to 12 ounces of cool water. With the stomach resting through the night, both mind and body will be more rested in the morning. When a person is stressed and overcommitted with a full schedule of activity until just before bedtime, it is difficult to fall asleep and sleep well. Often excessive stress and pressure are self-imposed and are driven by feelings of insecurity and inferiority. In this case, a healthy spiritual focus is often what is needed, although it may not be as simple as counting your blessings instead of sheep. Personal issues may need to be examined in the light of God's love and care for us, which may be accomplished through personal study or counseling. Chapter 8 elaborates on this subject. When individuals develop a healthier perspective, reprioritize duties, relax, and experience inner peace, they usually fall asleep more easily. It is interesting that a workaholic may have difficulty sleeping, but an inactive bored person can have the same problem. It is true that anxiety and hyperactivity make it difficult to fall asleep, but on the other end of the spectrum, boredom, such as is often experienced following retirement, may also result in nights of tossing and turning. Taking up a new hobby or volunteering for a church ministry or a service organization may help restore a sense of worth and purpose. Filling the day with interesting and profitable activities can also combat sleep disorders. Sometimes a very simple adjustment can be helpful in relieving insomnia, such as creating a dark, quiet room and being as still as possible after going to bed. Eliminating the clock in the bedroom to avoid focusing on how long the time of wakefulness may be helpful. This may not be practical for those with time-sensitive commitments, but if feasible, may prove to be beneficial. Another means of inducing sleep is to engage in a calm activity, such as reading spiritual material or listening to soothing music for 15 to 30 minutes before retiring. A season of prayer, though certainly not recommended solely for the purpose of inducing sleep, may also have a calming effect. These activities will not only be relaxing, but may help by providing a distraction from trying intently to fall asleep. A summary of sleep aids is afternoon or early evening exercise outdoors in the daylight, early light supper, if supper is eaten at all, avoiding caffeine, alcohol, and nicotine, avoiding burning the midnight oil, effective stress management, schedule reasonable work hours, eliminate the bedroom clock, fall asleep in a dark, quiet room, lie still shortly after going to bed, use regular sleep-wake scheduling, avoid excessive daytime boredom, and soothing music, reading, and spiritual materials as well as prayer are helpful. Sleep disturbances can be either a cause or a result of depression. In either case, treating the sleep disorder is a key to preventing depression. Several lifestyle measures that may ensure a good night's rest also offer health benefits as well, including weight loss and increased energy. Improved sleep habits, in combination with these other enhancements to overall health, could be powerful aids in relieving depression. Bright light therapy. Seasonal affect disorder, SAD, is a common condition in northern latitudes like the Scandinavian countries and Alaska. It occurs most often in winter when there is little or no sunlight, even at noon. The condition has identical symptoms to depression and resolves when individuals are exposed to bright light 2,000 to 10,000 lux for at least 30 minutes a day. This amount of brightness can be achieved indoors by being exposed to a special bright light, such as an Apollo light, or being outdoors in the United States at similar latitudes at least 30 minutes after sun up and at least 30 minutes before sundown. The only mandatory exposed human surface to the light is the eyes. Outdoor light is amazingly more intense than the normal indoor variety. Outdoor light can reach 50,000 lux on a bright sunny day. A bright indoor environment may provide only 400 lux, less than 15% of daylight brightness. Bright light, such as sunlight, increases serotonin production in the daytime, which can in turn treat depression and fatigue. Bright light exposure in the day may also increase blood melatonin levels at night, which can create more restful and efficient sleep. Bright light therapy can also help restore the normal daily body rhythm called the circadian rhythm. If a person has problems with early morning awakening, anywhere between 3 to 5 a.m., but needs more sleep, exposure to bright light in the early evening for 30 minutes, or 15 minutes of blue light, can restore the normal sleep pattern. For the more common problem of not being able to fall asleep at bedtime, insomnia, combined with awakening too late in the morning, exposure to early morning bright light, between 6 to 8 a.m., can restore the normal sleep cycle. Utilizing morning light therapy for depression brings superior results to evening light therapy, although evening therapy is better than no light therapy at all. I usually recommend an exercise program that is outdoors in the morning sun. This is not possible for everyone to do in the winter when the sun comes up later. For these people, I recommend a lunchtime outdoor exercise period, such as a brisk walk for 30 minutes. Others, who are fortunate enough to have a south side office window that brightens their room enough that indoor light is unnecessary, can often get by without taking the aforementioned outdoor exercise precautions. However, there is one additional important benefit of outdoor exercise to consider: negative ions. Fresh country air has negative ions that have been demonstrated to both treat and prevent depression. Avoid negative thinking. This particular lifestyle measure cannot be overemphasized. I've had many patients, including Amanda, point to this particular lifestyle measure as perhaps the most important in leading them to success in depression-free living without the use of medications. Researchers at Ohio State University in Columbus studied 224 middle-aged and older adults who were already dealing with significant stress in their lives. At one-year intervals for 3 years, participants reported their degree of optimism and pessimism, negative life events, depression, stress, anxiety, and other issues. The researchers found that optimism and pessimism, previously thought to be linked, are actually independent factors that individually influence stress and non-stressed people. One factor is more influential than the other. Specifically, pessimism predicted anxiety, perceived stress, and self-rated lack of physical health for the next year. An optimistic attitude did not predict anything. This requires retraining of the thought process. I have found that many depressed individuals have a tendency to look at the downside of life. We are well aware that there always will be things in this imperfect world to complain about. We are helpless to personally do anything about many of these negative things or events. In contrast, focusing the mind on enjoying the wonderful blessings of life is not only uplifting, but also therapeutic. As soon as conscious awareness of an unconstructive, negative thought is realized, a positive thought should immediately replace it. This means that the person should plan ahead as to what positive thought to contemplate so that no delay in thought shifting occurs. The human brain is both flexible and trainable, and as positive thoughts become habitual, depression will likely become a thing of the past. One religious author stated, "It is a positive duty to resist melancholy, discontented thoughts and feelings as much a duty as it is to pray." If negative thinking people were visiting a beautiful park and saw low clouds and dead leaves, they would complain that they did not choose another day to be there. Others would revel in seeing the grand mountains and the valley clothed with living green and the beautiful flowers. Incidentally, this may be one of the reasons that country music, now the most listened to music in the U.S., does not come out on top in uplifting the mood. Melancholic guitars accompanied by voices and lyrics combine to complain about a wrecked pickup, lost dog, or missing ex-spouse. Even though the rhythm may be classified as upbeat, the effect does not truly uplift the thoughts. Daily spiritual exercises. An interreligious experience has been found to be effective in recovery from depression, according to several studies. Several studies show that depressed patients with higher interreligiosity recover sooner than non-religious patients. Going through the form of religion without firm belief is of little benefit. Daily reading of the scriptures is recommended for improved mental health. For just under a year, researchers from Duke University in North Carolina used diagnostic interviews to track the emotional well-being of 94 individuals, each of whom was more than 60 years of age. They all had been diagnosed as suffering from depression upon discharge from a hospital. Some of their tests and questions focused on the study participants' level of interreligiosity. To ascertain this level of interfaith, researchers used a 10-question evaluation test that had been developed with the help of Christian ministers and Jewish rabbis. They also established the level of each participant's external religious practice, activities such as service attendance and involvement in church-related clubs and activities. During the course of the study, 54% of the participants recovered from their depression. Religion helped in that recovery. Depressed patients with higher intrinsic religiosity scores had more rapid remission than patients with lower scores, according to the study. In fact, patients recovered from depression 70% sooner with every 10-point increase in the religiosity evaluation test score, but the researchers found that external religious activity had much less of an impact. The Duke team urges psychiatrists to initiate inquiries into the patient's religious faith, especially when the patients are depressed, since these beliefs may bring comfort and facilitate coping. Other studies have found that strong religious faith is not only helpful in treating depression, but also in preventing it. Many studies have suggested that going through the forms of religion without firm belief does little, if any good, to overall mental health. Thus, I do not emphasize a casual reading of the Bible, but a serious study that contemplates the themes of Scripture. Reading and meditating on a chapter of the book of Proverbs each day, with the chapter number corresponding to the day of the month, there are 31 chapters, has been helpful for many of my depressed patients. Memorizing and reciting a text a week that summarizes or succinctly states a beautiful scriptural idea is also very helpful. One new program that has met with wonderful worldwide success in accomplishing these objects is called FAST, F-A-S-T. This concludes the presentation of 7 general lifestyle elements. We will now look at several lifestyle treatments that will not apply in general, but will be helpful to certain people with specific needs. 6 selective lifestyle treatments. So far, I've discussed general lifestyle principles that will be a benefit to practically every depressed person. Even those who are not depressed can decrease their risk of ever contracting depression as well as improve their own mood and outlook on life by following such a program. Now we will explore lifestyle measures that can be a benefit to select individuals and, arguably, could be a benefit to most depressed patients. These lifestyle measures are social support, cognitive behavioral therapy, codependency therapy, owning a pet, hydrotherapy, and stress control measures. The importance of social support. In animals and in humans, isolation leads to depression and withdrawal, while social support and a sense of belonging leads to improved mood and improved mental and physical health. The importance of strong social support should not be underestimated. Some of the benefits are that a sense of belonging improves mood and mental health, social support reduces risk of death following a heart attack. A busy social life does not guarantee a sense of belonging. The importance of strong social support should not be underestimated. One study showed that good support of families and friends can be life-saving. After suffering a heart attack, 887 patients were followed for a year. Researchers evaluated the patients for depression soon after they were transferred out of the intensive care units. The patients were asked questions about the support they received from family, friends, or a special person. Soon after the heart attack, about a third of the patients were mildly or moderately depressed. Patients who were depressed were more than three times as likely to die during the year after having the heart attack. The effect of depression on survival varied depending on a person's perceived social support. The odds of dying were highest in depressed people who felt that they did not get enough support from friends, families, and loved ones. In contrast, the depressed patients who felt the strongest support by friends and family were not any more likely to die than a non-depressed person. In addition, symptoms of depression were much more likely to improve in depressed patients who felt well supported. Another study suggested that there is something even more important than perceived social support. This particular study sent questionnaires to 31 patients with major depression and to 379 community college students in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Questions focused on issues such as psychological sense of belonging, the extent of one's social network and social activities, and feelings of conflict and loneliness. The study showed that from all social factors considered, a sense of belonging is the best predictor of what an individual might experience in terms of depressive symptoms. The point is that many friends and a busy social life do not necessarily equate with a strong sense of belonging. An individual may have friends that he does not feel belong to him. I recommend that individuals who do not have a close family or close friends, especially if they have a low sense of belonging, involve themselves in certain community or church projects that are consistent with their own goals. They'll often form close relationships in the process, and with a sense of common purpose, will soon feel truly belonged. Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. For many years, psychotherapy, counseling, as practiced by most mental health professionals, was an open-ended, unstructured process aimed at uncovering so-called unconscious reasons for depression. A lot of time was spent on how the individual was raised as a child and other past events that may have shaped the person's feelings and behaviors. This lengthy, intensive effort has never been proven effective in the treatment of depression or any other mood disorder. Even though this type of counseling has never been shown to be better than taking a placebo pill for depression, it is still practiced by many mental health professionals today. Fortunately, a relatively new form of psychotherapy is emerging that has been shown to be superior: cognitive behavioral therapy. Dozens of controlled clinical trials during the past 20 years have established the effectiveness of cognitive behavioral therapy in the treatment of major depression and dysrhythmic disorder. This particular type of therapy is focused, time-limited, and directed at the specific needs of the depressed individual. It aims at identifying and correcting erroneous interpretations of events and negative automatic thoughts that may initiate or perpetuate a depressed mood. The focus is very much on the depressed individual and what he can do differently, not on finding circumstances or others to blame. Chronic depression has an earned reputation of being very difficult to treat. By definition, chronic depression has to have lasted for greater than 2 years. Often, the depressed individual has not responded to medication, counseling, or other therapy. A recent landmark study showed that a combination of the antidepressant drug Suzone and intensive psychotherapy effectively reduces or eliminates chronic depression in a record 85% of patients. No other study has ever shown such a dramatic response. Not surprisingly, the type of psychotherapy used was the cognitive behavioral analysis system. "We were stunned," said the leading investigator, Martin Keller, of Brown University. "None of us had anticipated we'd show anything close to an 85% response rate for the combination. Patients of the combination did significantly better than those undergoing the counseling or the medication by themselves." The study highlights the importance of using a combination of successful approaches to more effectively combat depression. Therapy for Codependency. Chapter 3 describes the unhealthy mental condition and causes of codependency. Therapy that works for codependency should be directed toward the primary cause of the condition, low self-worth. Low self-worth is primarily a spiritual problem, in my view, a lack of perception of the value of each of us in the sight of our Maker. How much is a person worth? What someone else thinks, or even what you think, of your own personal worth sinks into insignificance when compared with what God, the ruler of the universe, thinks of you. Our Creator loves you so much that He gave His only beloved Son to save you, even though you did not love Him. The scriptures cited at the previous endnote imply that for one person, Christ would, to save one, have chosen his life of toil and humiliation and his death of shame. Thus, one person is worth what the Son of God is worth, infinite value. No wonder the Apostle Paul asks, "Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword?" He answered his own question with a resounding no, then continued with a declaration of the strength of God's love in Romans 8:38-39, which says, "For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels nor principalities, nor powers, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature, shall be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus our Lord." The love of God for one person is a wonderful, exhaustless subject. Once studied, one begins to realize that one person is worth more in God's sight than the entire physical world. For those who are suffering from love hunger or codependency, I recommend that they spend a thoughtful half hour a day contemplating and reading about the life of Christ, especially the last 24 hours before his cruel death. Two books, along with the Bible, that have helped many people accomplish this are The Desire of Ages and The Story of Redemption. Self-worth versus self-esteem. There is a difference between self-worth, infinite value, and what is usually referred to as self-esteem. Webster's definitions are self-esteem, pride, conceit, self-love. Self-worth, the value of self. Codependents often have low self-esteem, as well as low self-worth. As a result, many therapists try to build up self-esteem by reciting the client's wonderful positive traits, which naturally tend to result in an inflated ego. This sometimes appears to benefit clients in the short term, but I've found that it often fails in the long term. The Apostle Paul, who understood the infinite self-worth of every individual, also stated, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself." I have found that many codependents make poor decisions based on pride and what others might think of them, instead of determining first what the right decision is and then following through on the decision. The dual concepts of infinite self-worth, based on the Everlasting Father's infinite love, and what he has done for the individual, and humility, are usually necessary for the person to break free from the cycle of poor decisions that often permeate the codependent's life. The psychology literature correctly speaks of self-esteem as pride. Unfortunately, it also speaks of self-esteem as self-worth. The two terms are used interchangeably. The only way to detect the difference in the literature is by the context, or how self-esteem was determined in the study. Doing the right thing. Love needs law to guide it. For instance, the Ten Commandments are often referred to as the law of God, yet these same commandments are referred to in both Old and New Testaments of Scripture in terms of deep and lasting love and are summarized as love to God and love to man. Christ said, "If we love him, we will keep his law." Love without law, not based on principle, is not true love at all. Consider a woman whose husband is an alcoholic. She may often try to protect him. The reasons can stem from, "This is what is expected," to, "He might lose his job if I turn him in," to, "He might decide to leave me if I do what's best for him." Because the perceived consequences of doing what is right seem rather troublesome, the codependent wife often unwittingly assists the codependent addict to continue the addiction. What follows is a litany of unforeseen consequences that are worse than what would have happened if the right thing had been done originally. It is crucial for a codependent wife to ask, what is the right decision? If she doesn't know, then she should seek counsel specifically to determine what is right. Then she should carry out that decision. For instance, the addict's loved one must undergo an intervention. This means that those who care about him must converge on him simultaneously to help him admit his problem so that he can get the help he needs to overcome the addiction. To carry out such a decision, counseling from a person experienced in helping addicts admit their true condition so that the addict is willing to seek essential help is often necessary to perform the intervention successfully. Instead of living life based on feelings and emotion, it is important for the codependent wife to surrender those feelings to principle, strong as they may be. The result will be a life led by true love, guided by principle, instead of a life guided by pride, infatuation, fear, and a train of unpleasant results. Owning a pet. One basic human adult need is to be needed. Pets are loving toward humans as well as dependent upon them. Elderly depressed patients have had their moods improved by owning a pet. A recent study showed that depressed AIDS patients who owned a pet reduced their risk of contracting depression. The benefit is especially pronounced when people are strongly attached to their pets and have few close confidants. I recommend pets for those who do not have close, caring friends or family and who are unable to successfully implement the recommendations under the social support section. Hydrotherapy. For more than 100 years, mental illness has occasionally been treated with warm baths utilizing natural hot springs or other sources. Before the 1950s, special showers, baths, wet sheet wraps, and other forms of hydrotherapy were routinely used in psychiatric hospitals throughout the United States and Europe. These approaches were not only used to treat depression, but were also used to treat delirium, agitation, insomnia, gastrointestinal disturbances, and pain syndromes. Recent research now confirms that normal subjects who were passively warmed just before going to bed have an improved quality of sleep as measured by brain wave analysis, EEG. Since sleep disturbance occurs in as many as 90% of individuals with major depression, could warm baths actually assist in treating depression? Warm baths can help, according to a recent preliminary study conducted at Michigan State University. More than 40 patients ranging from 18 to 62 years of age who were admitted to a hospital psychiatry unit with an episode of major depression were given a warm 30-minute bath just before going to bed. Improvements occurred in tension, anxiety, anger, hostility, confusion, bewilderment, and depression. The findings were the same for both men and women. Stress combined with depression. Stress coexists with depression so frequently that this combination is the rule rather than the exception. Often the same medications are used to treat each one alone. Many of the remainder of the depressed patients feel stressed out, unable to cope effectively with the stress in their lives. If stress is a significant component that appears related to their depression, I encourage them to also adopt the stress control program outlined in Chapter 8. In conclusion, lifestyle changes need to take place if the person is to break free from depression and the complications of medications that come with it. Amanda's experience of being able to live happily without the use of antidepressant medication is not unique. Countless others have found the way to lasting happiness and meaning by changing their lifestyle for the better. Although some of the changes may seem hard at first, the end result will be a life that is much more pleasant, meaningful, and uncomplicated.
You've been listening to Depression the Way Out by Dr. Neil Nedley, copyright 2014. To purchase this or other books by Dr. Nedley, or to learn more about their 10-day residential or their 8-week community programs, visit www.nedleyhealthsolutions.com.